Good afternoon. This is Friday, February 3rd, 2012. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect. It is approximately 3:34 p.m. on this Friday, February 3rd. We do have a quorum with us today. We are joined by co-chair Senator Wagner. We have Senator Stevens, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski. I understand we will soon be joined by Senator Stedman and likely also soon joined by Senator McGuire and obviously myself, Senator Paskvin. Please turn off your cell phones so that even the vibrate at time can interfere with the communication that we get on the record. Anyway, the purpose of our meeting today is to learn about the North Slope of Alaska Facility Sharing Study. This was originally released in 2004, and we will also hope to learn of the historical and current water and gas handling constraints on the North Slope. These are issues that must be advanced, and we as the legislature and the public need to receive this information so that we have the full spectrum of reasons why the decline in Alaska's oil production is with us today and why that decline began in 1989. It is an important topic that I believe has received too little attention. We cannot and should not talk about North Slope oil production without talking about the scientific and engineering facts of both the below-ground reservoir and the above-ground infrastructure in addition to the economic variables. We welcome Senator Stedman. He is with us now, so record should reflect that. Anyway, the definitive study on facility sharing agreement and the title of that report is North Slope of Alaska Facility Sharing Study, and it was written in the year 2004 by Petrotechnical Resources Alaska. And the Resources Committee is honored to have us here today, Mr. Tom Walsh, to present that study that he was one of the authors of. And Mr. Walsh has indicated to me that he will answer questions presented to him by the committee, and it's his preference that the questions be asked while the slide is on the screen, but certainly will take any question. But following Mr. Walsh's presentation, we will have Director Bill Barron, who is with us in the audience, I believe. There he is. And he will offer a follow-up from the Division of Oil and Gas and provide an analysis of where we are now on these same issues. And if we have time, Director Barron will also speak briefly about a few of the exciting advances in oil drilling and extraction technology. And I should also indicate that in the near future that I would hope to hear directly from the industry regarding their current understanding of facility sharing and processing facility constraints and what might also be generally understood as debottlenecking issues that are important for the Central North Slope. But at this time, Mr. Tom Walsh, welcome to the Senate Resources Committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and then the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman Paskvin, Chairman Wagner. Good afternoon, Senators French, Wilikowski, Stedman, and Stevens. As Chairman Paskvin stated, my name is Tom Walsh. I am a managing partner and founder of Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska, an oil and gas consulting firm in Anchorage, Alaska. We've been in business since 1997, serving the needs of many clients in the state of Alaska. The major oil companies are a major client of ours. We work for the state of Alaska. We work for the federal government. We've worked for the native corporations and the independent oil companies. So we pretty much work for everyone with an interest in oil and gas in Alaska, primarily with professional technical employees. I appreciate the opportunity to come today and speak to you about this report. I was a little taken aback, thinking that, you know, the report is 7 years old, and I had to do a little bit of brushing up to be prepared for this. But hopefully the slides that we'll go through today will be of some interest and value for the committee.
Mr. Walsh, if I could just interject. I forgot to identify Senator Giesel is in the audience, and we should have the record reflect her presence. And I don't believe that there are any other elected officials here, but anyway, please continue.
My particular credentials for presenting this paper today, I was one of the authors of the paper. We had several authors working on the paper. It was a fairly broad topic. We had a number of people assisting in the preparation. As I mentioned, I'm a managing partner and was the project lead on this particular effort. I'm a geophysicist by background. And I have really spent the last probably 8 to 10 years doing project management for our oil and gas consulting firm. And this is a type of project that we very much enjoy getting involved in. It's a very important topic for the state of Alaska and for all stakeholders, and something that we appreciate the opportunity to help.
Senator Wagner.
Yes.
Just real quick, who was the study done for initially?
Oh, yes. Thank you. The study was commissioned by the Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you.
And that, again, that was in 2004, I believe in May 2004. You're just ahead of me, Senator. Facility sharing is critical for the future of oil and gas industry on the North Slope. That's a conclusion from the study. As I mentioned, delivery of the final report was back in May of 2004. The slides that I'm presenting today are pretty much just taken right out of the report, and I believe that everyone has been provided a copy of that report. I've tried to basically take the figures and bullet points directly from the report. I will try to refrain from speaking about things that have happened since the report was completed and the present time, with a few exceptions. Basically, PRA has not updated this report. There has been some work done by the Division of Oil and Gas, and Director Barron will be addressing those updates after my presentation.
And Mr. Walsh, just, you know, we have a television camera here, and, you know, members of the public may be viewing this. We hope they are viewing this and trying to understand a little bit more about the oil industry itself. So if we come to terms such as facility sharing, you have a high level of knowledge of what the facility it is that they're referencing and what facility sharing means. And so some of these other terms, if at, you know, from time to time, you might just step aside a little bit and describe what you mean when you're using a term for the first time.
Okay, thank you for that note.
Senator Stevens has a question.
Just a general question, Mr. Chairman. Why are we just receiving a report from 2004? Has it never been presented to the legislature before?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, the report was actually delivered with a presentation to the Division of Oil and Gas back in 2004. To my knowledge, it has never been presented to the legislature in those intervening years. It has been published on the Division of Oil and Gas website since 2004 and was actually prominently displayed, I think, on the home page for quite a long time, which was wonderful for us to see our logo on the home page, but it's been moved a little further down now. But to my knowledge, it hasn't been presented to the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stevens.
So just as an overview statement, and I appreciate Chairman Passman's comments on trying to explain terms as we go through the motivation for preparing this study really was to look at the existing facilities on the North Slope of Alaska, production facilities that produce oil and separate gas and water from that oil and eventually transport through the pipeline system that oil to the market. Those existing facilities have been established over the last 30 years on the North Slope, and they have produced a great deal of hydrocarbon from the North Slope. There were perceived at the time to be opportunities for third-party access to those facilities to increase production on the North Slope, and that was really the kind of the guiding principle behind this this study.
And Mr. Walsh, if I could interject, by third parties, are you meaning potential producers other than the big three oil companies?
Thank you. Yes, Chairman Pasquin, that would be independent exploration and potential production companies that are not owners of those facilities. So the motivation on the first slide here states, and this is again from the written report, a primary motivation is to avoid regulation of facilities access. And basically it was felt that the opportunity for facilities access was available. There is interest on all sides for that access to occur, and it was perceived that it would be better for that access to occur on a voluntary basis rather than through regulation. And I still believe that holds true. Another motivation was to develop fair and equitable sharing process for North Slope facilities access. And by that, what we're implying is that the owners of those facilities need to benefit from offering the opportunity to utilize the facilities, as well as the independent producers or third-party producers that don't own those facilities that would like to process their liquids through those facilities. So there needs to be mutual benefit on those two parts, as well as another stakeholder, the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska would like to see conservation measures whereby we don't waste any production, any resources. We develop things in a very economic and environmentally friendly manner, that the state benefits from the production of those hydrocarbons. So the state obviously is a stakeholder as well. And so finally, just achieve mutual benefit for all parties. And I think just getting information out about the existing facilities, what the opportunities might be for sharing those facilities, and what the constraints associated with that sharing were all drivers behind the project. Project goals, first was to characterize the existing facilities. There is I have a slide coming up, three slides coming up, that show the exploration activities at the time, at the 2004 period, production facilities in place at that time, as well as all the pipelines that have been constructed across the North Slope. That was one level, was just looking at, you know, map view of what facilities actually exist, where they are geographically, and then really peeling the layers of the onion back to determine what components go into those facilities, all the way down to the separation facilities, the vessels, the pipelines, the wells. There's a huge assortment of asset up there, as you all well know. And we looked at that in fairly great detail to determine, again, what existed and what opportunities might there be for bringing production through those facilities. And another point was to tabulate the current throughput of those facilities. That's something that was partially gained through the public records, through the AOGCC files, as to what oil, gas, and water are produced through existing fields. But to get to the level of flow stations, gathering centers, CPFs, you really have to get that information from the operators. So this was something that from the very beginning was going to require significant input from the operating companies, the owner companies of those facilities. So that's really where the tabulation of current throughput would have come from. And then quantify theoretical capacities. Again, that's something that comes from the design specifications of those facilities, and is something that really comes from the operating and owner companies. And then finally, to identify, quantify, and market excess capacity. And the idea there being to get the word out that these facilities do exist. There may be excess capacity in one or more of these facilities, and let that be known to the independent community to basically try to drum up more business. One of the concerns that independents have always had up here is just access to land, to data, and to production facilities. So everything above the common carrier pipelines, was really something that not a lot of people understood. So it was really about getting that information out to them. So hopefully it would attract them to come and explore in Alaska on the North Slope. Continuing the project goals, disseminate information to encourage hydrocarbon development on the North Slope was really the point I just made. And then identify the needs and desires of the independent explorers and producers, as well as the needs and desires of the North Slope facility owners and operators, and try to get everyone on the same page and create a dialogue whereby people could start negotiating for facility access. Another point was to describe how facility access is managed in other oil and gas provinces. So we looked at a Canadian example and a Norway example and utilized that in terms of creating guideline principles for facilities sharing negotiation for North Slope potential producers. And then develop guidelines for facility access on the North Slope. So taking all this information and putting together a set of guidelines and principles so that people had kind of a cookbook to go and start negotiating facility access. The parties that are impacted by the issues, I spoke to this earlier, the major oil companies that are currently producing and operating on the North Slope, they own the facilities on the North Slope. They are currently were producing oil and cycling gas and water through those facilities, separating the gas and water from the oil so that the oil could be shipped down the pipeline. Potential third-party producers attempting to explore and develop on the North Slope. There are opportunities, and as we go through the presentation, you'll see kind of what some of the constraints are to those opportunities. It's not a slam dunk that if you make a discovery on the North Slope of Alaska that it makes sense to go through existing facilities, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the state of Alaska is a shareholder and obviously commissioned this report, was very interested in the findings that came out. Some of the benefits of facilities access, mitigate North Slope oil decline by including independents. So basically trying to bring in more low gas cut and water cut oil. All the oil that's produced on the North Slope.
If I could interject, you use the term low gas cut and right. Low water cut.
I'll explain that.
If you could sidestep and explain exactly what that means, and possibly in the context of the larger reservoir and as a field matures also.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Passman. Yes. What I mean by that statement, high GOR gas oil ratio or water cut oil, all the barrels of oil that are produced on the North Slope of Alaska and typically around the world have a component of water and gas associated with them. If you have a means of exporting gas to market, you sell that gas. The water typically is something that is recycled and injected back into the ground. There is actually value to the water as well in terms of pressure support in trying to maintain the reservoir pressure in the subsurface to keep the oil flowing out. So, for instance, at the current time, the Prudhoe Bay production is very high in gas content. We are cycling about 9 billion cubic feet of gas a day through Prudhoe Bay. That gas is coming back out in the production. We're basically picking up oil with that gas and stripping that oil out when we go to separate it. So as these fields mature, the amount of water that is produced with the oil and the amount of gases produced with the oil is climbing, and the amount of oil that's produced is reducing. So we get what's called high GOR gas oil ratio oil and high water cut oil. Does that make sense? Anyone have any questions on that?
If you could give possibly an example of what it was like in 1980 when you bring any reservoir, but, you know, like Prudhoe Bay, bring it online, what are the expectations of your gas-to-oil ratio or water-to-oil ratios, and how are those expected to change over time? What's the engineering or scientific understanding of that concept?
Okay, thank you for that, Chairman. I don't have the facts at my fingertips in terms of what the initial gas oil ratio and water oil ratio were for Prudhoe or Kuparuk, but I can say that the Kuparuk field, just looking at I hope to not step on Director Barron's toes here, but looking through his slide set, he's got the current numbers, and very intriguing to see that the average gas cut in the Prudhoe field now, I believe, is 20,000 standard cubic feet per barrel of oil that's produced. And what that means is that for every barrel of oil that's produced, there are 25,000 feet of natural gas compressed into that barrel. And when you bring that to the surface, it turns into just natural gas. And you've got to do something with that natural gas. So Prudhoe is cycling that and reinjecting it into the field. When Prudhoe first came online, that number would have been significantly less, and I don't recall exactly what it was, and I won't quote that because there are many people possibly listening in that know much more about that than I do, but it would have been many-fold less.
And Director Barron's is in his slide, and I think yes. He's prepared to address that, but Senator French.
In case anyone's listening, they should know it's somewhere way underneath 5, just for example. In 1980, it was way underneath 5, maybe 2 or 3, so
thank
significantly
you.
Smaller.
Yes, I was thinking 4, but I didn't want to quote that, but thank you, Senator French. So that just gives a little bit of an overview of the issues, and what we'll talk about some of these constraints, and the handling of this gas and water become a significant constraint in managing these facilities as the oil is produced.
Mr. Walsh, if you could, and again, this is, I think, a critical point that needs to be better understood both by this committee and the public that's listening, is the understanding of why the production or the throughput of oil decline began in the first place.
Yes. The basically, fields are designed and facilities are designed to maximize throughput to commercially develop a field. And so you build your facilities to reach a certain plateau of production that you will try to extend for as long as you can, and your facilities are built constrained to that initial oil flow. You want to maximize that oil flow up front, and you typically build your facilities to handle that. At some point, there are two things that happen. There are several things that happen, but two of the critical things are that your oil volume has been reduced to the state that it is now depleting, and it's declining. The other constraints are on handling water and gas. And so when you reach a point where you are having to separate a significant volume of gas and water from your oil that you're producing, you reach the initial facility capacities on handling that gas and water. And basically, again, they're separating out gas and water, reinjecting both into the field. And you reach a point where your facilities to handle gas and water are exceeded in capacity, and your field starts to decline in that sense. There have been numerous expansions of facilities at all of the major producing assets on the North Slope that I'm sure you know about. In terms of handling gas and expanding the volume of gas that can be separated and reinjected, and the same thing with water, where expansions have been done such that you can handle more gas and more water and reinject that gas and water and keep your oil flow rate going. Even with those gas expansions and water handling expansion, you will reach constraints again in the future, and it becomes an issue of, I use the example of an old car. You get to a point where you've invested so much in that car that you say, I'm going to change the oil and continue driving it and fill it up with gas, but you're probably not going to go out and have the whole body replaced and replace the engine. You've invested over what the value of the car is. At some point, oil and gas processing facilities get to that point where you have made such extreme investments to get all the oil out that it no longer makes sense to continue to invest. And all the future investments do is accelerate production. They don't really create new oil. All you're doing is allowing for cycling of gas and water that will bring that oil to the surface faster. There's no new oil there, no new added value. You're just adding investment to accelerate your production. So these are some fairly complicated issues that that oil and gas companies look at as they look at commercializing assets. These issues go into a model to define your initial development and the design of your production facilities. And then as time goes on, you continue to look at that and look at investment opportunities to increase the production capacity. Next bullet point was reduce unit operating and transportation costs, and I've got a slide coming up that will address that, but basically bringing oil into the system that doesn't have as much gas and water that need to be separated and reinjected lowers the lifting costs, because handling water and gas is expensive. If you bring in new oil that doesn't have water and gas in it, you reduce your lifting costs. So reducing unit operating costs is done by bringing in low GOR, low gas cut oil, and low water cut oil. Another benefit is extending economic field life for mature fields. Eventually, every field will go to the decline point where you really can't get any more oil out and you reach your economic limit. If we bring in new oil to the facilities, it will extend the base production as well as add new production to those facilities and extend field life. Accelerate new field development. If third-party explorers and producers are able to shorten their cycle time, if you make a discovery right next to a producing asset and you put in a 1 mile piece of three-phase pipeline, you can turn things around a lot faster than you can if you're building your entire facility kit. So it does have the potential for accelerating new field development. Maximizing resource exploitation, just gathering up all these satellite pools around Prudhoe is a good example of that. And there are many companies that are doing just that. A good example is Jim Weeks the folks over at Ultrastar Exploration, who are getting ready to drill their third well right north of Prudhoe Bay. The size of that prospect is such that it would not really make sense to build new facilities, but it makes sense to bring that through existing facilities, and so that resource probably could not be exploited without the opportunity to use the existing facilities.
And then, Mr. Walsh, if I could just interject, you know, it brings up a topic that many people are interested in, is whether Prudhoe and Kuparuk have reached the end of economic life, or whether with these types of issues there is much more economic life.
Well, that is the subject of much debate at this point. I do have a slide that I'll show, a schematic slide of a production decline curve, and I believe Director Barron will be addressing that as well with more recent production decline information. I believe certainly the operators and owners of Prudhoe Bay have said there is a lot left to produce in Prudhoe Bay. And every barrel gets more expensive to develop, but we're certainly not at the end of commercial life of Prudhoe Bay at this point, or Kuparuk. So there is a lot more to be gained, and through this synergistic approach and potential for facilities sharing, I think that was kind of the carrot that the owner companies saw, was they would like to extend field life, they would like to extend the value of their assets into the future, and they see that opportunity through offering their facilities to other producers.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh.
And then finally, minimize waste and footprint.
Senator,
sorry.
Senator Wagner.
So PetroStar has a facilities sharing agreement?
PetroStar?
UltraStar.
Oh, sorry, UltraStar. Yes, Chairman Wagner. UltraStar does have a joinder agreement with Prudhoe Bay owners. that Jim had negotiated years ago before he drilled the first of the three wells that he intends to drill. So he is one example of a successful negotiation process that has that agreement in hand. Now, as I'll get to later, there are details within that agreement that are yet to be determined because, unfortunately, we haven't brought a barrel of oil to the surface yet that Ultrastar can bring to the facilities. And until you know what the quality and the specifications of that barrel of oil are, you can't come up with the final terms. And we'll talk about that in terms of evaluating back out and so forth.
I can start where I get fuel from my boat.
Okay, so finally, minimize waste and footprint. Obviously, we would... it's in everyone's interest. We've seen the owner-operator companies trying to reduce footprint, and there's some tremendous examples of minimal footprint. Directional drilling, of course, is the first thing that comes to mind, that you drill from one small pad and then making pads smaller and smaller. It makes sense to reduce our footprint, and if we can do that through existing facilities rather than building new facilities where it makes sense, then that's certainly a benefit. The slide that I've got here is a very schematic slide, just showing kind of one of the benefits. And on the y-axis, the vertical axis, we're looking at barrels of oil produced per day. Then on the x-axis is time, and this would be years. This is kind of a schematic view of a production decline curve. So the white line is the production curve, and it shows early in time. A high rate of barrels of oil produced on a plateau and then eventually going on decline and seeing that production decline to its economic limit somewhere out in time. And on the other axis there is dollars per barrel for lifting cost. And as you get fewer and fewer barrels coming to the surface, the cost per barrel increases. Due to the economy of scale. You're producing less barrels, you're basically doing the same things or more activity than you were doing before, and lifting costs go up. So one of the benefits that is possible here is kind of flattening out both of those curves and sharing in lifting costs, bringing more barrels into the system and flattening out the lifting cost curve, and then trying to flatten out the production decline curve by extending field life, bringing new barrels in that don't require as much separation and reinjection of fluids. So this is, again, it's kind of a very schematic slide, but it shows you some of the objectives and benefits of facilities sharing. The next slide is really, again, it's very schematic, but the idea, the concept here is to just grow the pie and make through facilities access create more opportunities for production on the North Slope, and kind of the idea here is that there are basically three major owners of facilities on the North Slope, with a lot of smaller partners, but basically three, you know, major owners of the facilities on the North Slope, and a given volume of oil that is accessing or being produced through those facilities. And the idea again here is that if we can provide access to potential third-party producers, the number of producers will grow and the whole pie will grow by bringing new oil into the system. And again, hopefully without disrupting the oil flow that's currently being produced by the owner companies. Some challenges that we recognized, one is to overcome unaligned interests, and certainly this is was a driving force in the desire to carry out this study by the Division of Oil and Gas. It was seen, and there were comments by independent companies saying that they would like to get access to the facilities, and they didn't really know how to do that. Some of the folks that were really very knowledgeable, I think you know, Jim Weeks is one of them that was a vice president at ARCO and knew things inside and out. Now he's on the other side of the table. He knew what the issues were for the operating companies and the owner companies, and he was able to speak their language, and he knew where the facilities were. He didn't need this report to go and negotiate his facilities access. But there were a lot of people that really didn't have that experience. And this was the idea here was to overcome those aligned interests by educating people on what the factors were.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On that topic, just looking at the 2004 study that was done, that this was one of the points that was raised then. And it says on page 5, the issue of facility sharing is critical for the future of the oil and gas industry on the North Slope. Have we broken through on that? I know there was one facility share agreement, it was Pioneer, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we've overcome that problem? Do you think we, since 2004, have moved forward in a way that will address the problems of this?
Thank you for the question, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. The I do believe, actually, this is something that came to mind when I was first asked to give this presentation today. I hadn't really thought about it a whole lot, but looking back, there are several examples of where people have viewed the opportunity and either exercised the opportunity to negotiate facilities access or gone with standalone facilities. I think the overlying picture here is that there really haven't been any significant discoveries since this report was written. Both the Kaichuk and Uguruk had been discovered in 2004, and were really in the beginning of their development stage at that point. And so there really hasn't been a great test of this, because there's nobody knocking on the door saying, I need to produce my oil through your facilities. And that's kind of a sad situation that we, you know, there's certainly last year or this current year, there's been more exploration on the North Slope than in my memorable history. And I would love to see some announcements of major discoveries and people wanting to negotiate facilities access. I do think that the report was helpful in getting the discussion going, and I do feel that everyone recognizes at this point that the opportunity does exist and that the owner companies are willing to talk about it. And when I talk to BP about it, they say, boy, we'll talk to anybody that can tell us, you know, what kind of barrel of oil they want to bring in, and we will work the terms for them.
Follow up on that. And I guess it's two things. Number one, as you mentioned, we do this year is going to be a good year for exploration. We will have a number of new companies coming in. So I guess question one is, do we have the framework in place? Do you have any recommendations for us? We want to increase production. One of the ways you do it is by solving this facilities access issue. Do you have any recommendations for us, number one, that you think we need to do this session? And number two, the facilities that we have right now, as you just have talked about, if someone were to make a discovery, could the current facilities even handle them? Because they do appear to be gas limited or water limited or both.
Right. Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Through the chair, that's very good questions. I guess I would probably hesitate to answer the first question about what you might do to assist at this point. I think that there are incentives in place for people to invest in their own facilities. I don't know that the state has really weighed in terms of incentives for facilities access. Personally, I'm more in favor of incentives than regulation and trying to force people to cooperate. But I do think, in answer to your second question, there are opportunities, and I guess one very good example is Badami. And Badami is a situation where it's really gone one step beyond facilities access. It's a situation where there is a great facility out there that is capable of producing 35,000 barrels of oil a day, and the subsurface just hasn't cooperated and the oil isn't there. But there is an awful lot of, there has been a lot of exploration activity around the Badami facilities. largely because that facility is existing and ready to take oil, and would be a great quick opportunity to get oil into the system. So when I say that it's gone beyond facilities access, basically, you know, BP offered a farm out of that facility and the acreage and said, we're not going to do anything with this. We would like somebody to come in here and use this facility. So that really is kind of the best example, and it's in the 2004 report. It's the one that clearly we'll see some slides coming up that will address that. But the pipeline was going to have capacity for many years, according to, you know, what we knew at the 2004 time frame, and the facilities were underutilized. So that was one that was just very obvious, and it's good to see that there is a lot of activity, and Savant and ASRC have partnered to explore and develop that area.
Senator French.
But just to finish up on that point, I mean, the more common situation is going to be like the one that Senator Wilikowski pointed out, where you've got a liquids and gas stressed facility and a new development near that facility. In order for this new development to get its oil into that facility, the owner of that facility's got to back off some of their own oil, back off some of their high GOR wells. And that gets complex because you're Absolutely. Giving up your own oil in favor of somebody else's. And you can imagine how hardball those negotiations are. And I just heard, you know, just from operators on the slope that the one place where it is working at CPF-3 and they're bringing in, I forget which company's oil is coming through CPF-3.
Pioneer is bringing Uguruk oil through CPF-3.
Yes. During summertime, it gets very rough because right. CPF-3 gets gas stressed and gas limited, and you know they're shutting off Uguruk's oil, I think Pioneer's a little slow to sort of complain about that because they don't want to, you know, they've got an arrangement, but it's a difficult arrangement. Let's just put it that way.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator French, for that follow up, and I think that brings up a great point. I think that, you know, it is a complex issue, and one of the issues that we'll talk about here on slides coming up is this concept of back out and the fact that there will be in CPF-3, as in any constrained facility, there will be oil that is currently being produced that's base oil production that needs to be backed out in order to put a new barrel of oil in. And it is complicated, and there are means for calculating the value of that back out, and that's something that is a very key negotiating point. So
I think we're going to get to this pretty quick in Mr. Walsh's presentation. So please continue.
Okay. Let's see. The second bullet point on this slide is address system dynamics. You know, what are the constraints? What are the opportunities? And then maintain high standard of operational integrity. When we have new producers coming on board wanting to access a pad or a facility or a production line or anything, there can be issues there because we have extremely high standards on the North Slope of Alaska, as we all know, and the very capable producers and operators that are working up there now are challenged to keep up with some of the issues with aging facilities. So bringing in new operators and accessing the aging facilities is a challenge that everyone is very cognizant of. And then reconcile conflicting asset valuations. One of the components of the cost of facilities access is just capital recovery. And so, the value of the capital equipment that is associated with the production of the third-party producer's oil, as well as future investments in that capital to accommodate their production, are issues that need to be negotiated. And we did talk about a couple of these examples, but and I don't think this slide is actually in your printed copy. I'm sorry about that. I added a couple this morning that I thought were important. But the first example here is the Pioneer Uguruk processing at the Kaparuk River Unit CPF-3. And that's a good example of a contract that was negotiated between two parties successfully and allowed for Pioneer to very quickly turn around their development of the Uguruk field. I mentioned earlier the Ultrastar Joinder Agreement for access to Prudhoe Bay facilities, and without that, the Ultrastar prospect would really be very challenged to be brought onto production because it is of a size that doesn't really support construction of standalone facilities. ENI, on the other hand, has developed the Nikaichuk field, and they have gone with standalone production facilities and are bringing pipeline quality oil to Kuparuk. That was a decision clearly that was educated by their commercial review and their look at what other opportunities there were. But as you look at going into constrained facilities and potentially paying back outs and capital fees and so forth, you have to look at whether it makes sense to build your own facilities. And this is an example where a company has gone that route.
Senator Wade.
Yeah, question to that point, and I know it's not a simple answer to give, but say Company A is an explorer and they come up with a well that they can put on commercial production. How do you evaluate whether it's worth it to them to build their own treatment facility or enter into negotiations with and maybe pay for the retrofitting of an existing facility to put that oil through?
Thank you, Chairman Wagner. That's a very good question, and it really is very dependent on that company's commercial terms. And the cost of capital to them and their target internal rate of return and so forth. I mean, when they build their commercial model, they have to look at that very closely. And there will be very clear cases where your discovery is large enough that it just doesn't make sense to go with facilities access, you would want to go with standalone facilities. For an outsider to do that review, it would be very difficult, and I don't really know how thoroughly ENI tested the opportunity to bring their production into existing facilities, but I'm sure that they went through very very diligent commercial modeling and analysis to determine that they wanted to go standalone.
They were quite hesitant to talk about it.
For purpose of the record, we will have through my office the additional slides, so if anyone does not have them, we will be able to, and we're going to make sure that they are incorporated in the full record of this proceeding. The question exists, I guess, in my mind is, are these water and gas issues unique to Alaska, or are they in other reservoirs around the United States or the world? In other words, is this something that is Alaska specific in any way?
Chairman Pasquan, it's the production characteristics and the increase in natural gas production or water production with barrels of oil is not by any means unique to Alaska. That part of it is very common throughout the world in oil and gas production. There are varying grades of oil in the various basins around the world. There are areas that have very waxy oil, very tar-rich oil. So there are lots of different constraints like that. The production characteristics of our oil are very good, and we're not unique in terms of the increase in having to deal with cycling gas and water. However, we are a bit unique in terms of the cost of developing assets on the North Slope. Obviously, we all know that it's very expensive. It's a very expensive region to operate. With the environmental issues, the cold and the remoteness and the environmental sensitivity and those types of things. So So that somewhat separates us from a lot of areas in Lower 48 where it's very capital intensive to build new facilities. So that's one motivating factor for looking at facility sharing or facilities access for, by third parties.
Thank you.
Another example that really hasn't been finalized yet, Brooks Range Petroleum has a very significant leasehold position on the North Slope and has been aggressively exploring their acreage and acquiring new acreage. They have leaned very much toward standalone facilities. Although they have an interest in discussing facilities access or facilities sharing, if the terms are right, but their model for development of their assets has really been based on satellite production facilities and trying to create satellite production facilities that would be shared by a number of producers. And the processing would occur there and then bring pipeline quality oil to the common carriers. Again, they don't have any commercial production yet, but I'm very hopeful that they will soon, and we'll see which way they go with that. They are very knowledgeable about the whole process of facilities access and certainly have the ability to negotiate terms as they see fit. I talked a bit about Badami, the farm out to Savant and ASRC, kind of taking it one step beyond and saying we've got these great facilities here. We just don't have oil to put into them. If somebody can find oil, we'd love to, you know, to farm that out. So that has taken place. And, again, very hopeful that some exploration success will occur out there or significant production through the Badami Reservoir. The final point here is that really – I think, as Senator Wagner pointed out, you know, it's very specific to case by case basis and company by company. It just has to be evaluated the benefit of facility sharing on a case by case basis, and each company has to look at it individually and decide whether it makes any sense for them to even begin the negotiation process. As part of information gathering that was associated with the report, we did query the operators and owners of the assets on the North Slope, and this was partially just to get their ideas of what the benefits might be from their side and get them thinking about it. When PRA got involved in this project, it was potentially a contentious situation for us to get into because we work for the independent companies, we work for the majors, we work for the state. So we're kind of putting ourselves in the middle of something that could turn into a hornet's nest, and we wanted to make sure that we got information from all parties. And so we went out to the operators and asked them what they saw as the benefits to the owners in facility sharing, and the response was very interesting, I thought, and very forthcoming. In most cases, the response was, well, we know that we will be facility constrained and we will be cycling a lot of gas and water and low on oil production going into our pipelines at some point in the future, and we will be actively marketing access to those facilities. We are very much in favor of creating an environment where people will come to us and negotiate terms. That was very refreshing, and it was a huge relief to me in that we did have common ground between the stakeholders and mutual benefit. So another point was what do you want potential third-party producers to know? And, again, the response was we want to get the information out there to let people know what assets exist, where there might be existing capacity that we could bring in barrels, and then what the terms would be if we have to back out oil. So just really educating the folks so that there weren't people coming to the wrong conclusion and basically saying there wasn't any opportunity for access. Just get the information out there. And I think going back to Senator Wilkowski's question, I think that this process did help a lot in that respect. Did educate people on what the issues were, and allowed for more of an open dialogue. The next question is the big question, where is existing or future excess capacity? And, you know, the quick response from the operators was, well, we're constrained in most of our assets. We're either at gas capacity constraint or water handling constraint, and so there will likely be backouts in a lot of cases. And as we went through the study, gathered information, we found out that that was very much the case. There were examples, again, going back to Badami, that there was virtually there was no production through Badami at that point, and you have this 35,000 barrel a day capacity facility that had no flow at the time. It was in warm shutdown. And then finally, what is the process and cost of gaining access? And that's kind of what we folded into our guidelines information that we got from the operating companies. And basically kind of merge that with what we gleaned from other facility sharing arrangements around the world. This next slide is a very much a schematic, and it's kind of like that production profile slide that I showed earlier, but very simplistic. And what we have is on the y-axis, again, is barrels of oil production per day. And a flat line at the top that says no vacancy, and that's a facility capacity constraint. So it could be gas handling, could be water handling, it could be wellbore constraint. You could have a field that would produce more if you just drilled more wells. So variety of constraints there, but really what we're talking about here is gas handling capacity and water handling capacity. And then the curved line that we see coming down below the no vacancy sign there is our production decline curve, just showing a plateau where you maximize your production of oil through the facilities, and then you reach capacity of gas handling or water handling, and you go on decline. You're depleting your oil supply, and you've reached your capacity limits on the gas handling or water handling, and you start to decline. So the blank area over here on the right is your oil here. Well, this is quite simplistic because the reason that blank area exists is, as I say, partly because you're depleting a limited resource, but also because you're constrained and you've maximized your ability to handle gas or water. So that's where it gets complicated. Again, this is very simplistic, but this was kind of the target we were looking for, is where we can fit oil into the system. I'm going to go through these next few pretty quick. I think I'm at my 1 hour here, so.
Well, I think it's very informative, so I want you to, if you can, to get through the presentation, because I think that this is useful to the committee, and I'm certain to the public as well.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Passman. The slide that we have on the screen now is one of the figures, figure 17 from the report, and it is a North Slope recent exploration activity. And I believe actually the Division of Oil and Gas produced this map, may have commissioned a company to do that, but I believe we got it from Division of Oil and Gas. But basically, this is a map that is current to 2004 time. There's been a lot of activity since then, but the key things to point out here are that we've got the Uguruk discovery in yellow up there, Pioneer, and Nikaichuk wells right beneath the Beaufort Sea label there. And again, those both now are in development, in production. Were really, you know, again, discovered at the time and took two different paths toward production of those assets. This slide doesn't show up very well, but this is the North Slope units and processing facilities, and all these strings on the map are production facilities and pipelines across the North Slope. And as you can see, there's a big spread from Badami on the east all the way over to Colville River unit on the west at Alpine. And again, you look at this and say, well, there must be lots of opportunities for facilities access. You've got, spread across the entire central North Slope. So the idea is then to ferret out just where are there opportunities for access in this system. And this next figure is the pipeline infrastructure across the North Slope. And again, the Badami pipeline going back to TAPS and the feeder lines within Prudhoe Bay, the line coming down from North Star, Milne Point to Kaparik, and then the Alpine pipeline coming across from Colville River. One thing I want to point out on this slide, I didn't draw the circles on here, but we did another study looking at really kind of the breakover geographically for determining whether you would build your own standalone facilities or try to access existing facilities. And really anything beyond 25 miles from a production facility is clearly the breakover in our analysis of when you would say it doesn't make sense to three-phase flow back oil, water, and gas to a production facility to have it separated. You would separate it or at least partial process it at the site and then send back one or two-phase production. This next slide is a basic production facility flow schematic. I'm not a facilities engineer. And I haven't played one on TV either, but this is,
you know, is it possible, and again, just out of courtesy to the witness that follows, you know, if you could hopefully, you know, get to the key points that you would
sure.
like to make and, you know, provide us with a summary. And
okay.
Again, I am finding this very fascinating and informative. But if we could get more to the key points that you would like to leave with this committee so that we could get to Director Behrens.
Okay, certainly. Yes, just very briefly on this slide then, this is just a schematic of a processing facility, and basically the oil comes in on the bottom left. It goes through several phases of separation where you separate out the gas, separate out the water. The water gets injected through injection wells, as does the gas get recompressed and injected back into the ground. So that's the process for separation and reinjection of fluids. This slide is about pipeline capacities and projected field production. So, again, we were in 2004. This was the pipeline capacities. And the key point here, actually I'll skip ahead because we've got some slides that talk more specifically about this, but there is room in the pipelines, the oil production or the oil transport pipelines, and particularly now we know that there's plenty of room in TAPS and all of the pipelines. So that's not the constraint. It really is the gas handling and water handling in the fields. I won't talk about this. This is TAPS pipeline specifications, just the quality of oil that has to be produced before you can go into TAPS. This is the slide I talked about, pipeline capacities. You can see the red line or the magenta line, the horizontal line here is design capacity for these pipelines, and Alpine actually exceeded its initial pipeline capacity, and there was an expansion. But for the most part, all of the pipelines on the North Slope at the 2004 time frame look like they would currently have room for oil transport, or in the very near future they would have room for oil transport. This next slide is a table that shows the various facilities, the fields, and what their constraints are. And basically what these show is that everything is near full or expected to be at capacity, with the exception of Badami, and there are significant constraints across the North Slope. So the finding the opportunities for access is the first challenge. That's a duplicate of that slide, so I'll skip forward. Just a quick example of the cost. The key components that go into the costs of facilities access are capital access, basically, you know, sharing the initial development or capital costs of the asset, and then the operating costs of processing liquid and gas and water. And then finally the back out, which I said could range from 2% to 50%. Back out is a key component. This slide is another schematic production profile, and this is a key one that I do want to just spend a minute on, is This is a just again a typical production profile. It could be North Slope production, but the big white blob on the bottom is the base production, and basically that's the main body of oil that's produced on the North Slope. And it's critical that we do everything we can to maximize that base production, and that's what the operators on the North Slope are doing everything they can to do, is to maximize that base production. The skin on top there, or the profile ad that is on top in blue, is an example of a satellite stream of fluids that comes in with very high quality oil, not a lot of processing required to handle that oil. And that beneath that is another shaded profile that shows the oil that would have to be backed out, that would be the facility operator's high gas cut or high water cut oil that would have to be backed out. And then finally, there's a profile over on the right-hand side of the slide that is when the satellite field starts to decline, you would bring those high GOR barrels or high water cut barrels back in. So it's deferred production that would come back in at a later time.
Senator Wagner has a question.
When you talk about those barrels that are backed out, don't they have to go through AOGCC and get permission to reduce their production of certain wells when they start that process?
Senator Wagner, actually, something like this occurs on a daily basis in the producing assets up there, where they look at the well set and they say, this well, the gas cut has gone up to a significant point that we're producing nothing but gas at this point. We're going to shut that well in. So they have a choke model that they determine which well should be flowing and which well should not. And they, you know, if they do shut in a well, they would notify the AOGCC that they're doing so. It would involve some process, but again, it's something that there would be demonstrable benefit in terms of conservation and in terms of production of better barrels of oil. The idea is that the best barrels get into the system. That's kind of the philosophy behind the facility sharing issue. Okay. Again, this is just a quick schematic of a backout concept, and that top barrel shows the red shading is showing gas. The oil is the thin green band, and then the water is the blue. So that's a low-value barrel of oil. It's got a lot of gas and a lot of water associated with it, whereas the nine barrels shown below that have very little gas and very little water. And so while you have to pay something to back out that low-value barrel of oil, you can bring in the other nine barrels, because the sum of the gas and water from those nine barrels might equal the sum of gas and water from the one barrel above. These guiding principles I'll just let people read later. I don't need to go through those, but just gives the kind of the guiding principles for facilities access and what we think are important issues to address between negotiating parties. And then in summary, facility owners and independents are generally supportive of facility sharing. I think, again, it needs to be on a case-by-case basis and reviewed on a case-by-case basis and company by company. But I do believe that the vehicle is there for all the facilities to have these discussions and negotiations. And I think the interest is there from all parties. The value of facility sharing is dependent on proximity of production to processing, the characteristics of the oil to be processed, and specific constraints. It's a complicated process, but the means of negotiating the terms are there. And then means of motivation to do exist to implement facility sharing agreements, and we talked about the two examples where there are agreements in hand. Not all cases will fit, so there will be cases like ENI that they will want to build their own facilities. And there is no oil currently being held up due to facility sharing issues that I know of. The only oil that might be held up because of constraints is the base production oil that really, if you built more facilities to handle more gas and more water, you would just accelerate the production of that base oil and accelerate the decline curve. And then finally, more transparency and more discoveries would be helpful. More oil, people coming to knock at the door to the operators and asking for access would be great, and more transparency in terms would be good as well. I'll let people read this last bit for themselves, but there, I mentioned that there was a team of folks that worked on this, as well as a great deal of input from the facility owners and the independent oil companies. And without their support, we could not have completed the study. And that, I believe, concludes the presentation, and appreciate your attention and all your great questions.
Mr. Walsh, again, on behalf of the entire Senate Resource Committee, thank you very much, you and Petrotechnical Resources Alaska, for doing the study in 2004 and presenting that study here today. In the interests of time, we need to get Director Behrens moving. But, again, thank you, Mr. Walsh. Yeah, we'll take a brief at ease in the event. Bring the Senate Resources Committee meeting back to order, and we now have the good fortune of having Director Behrens with us today. Director, if you please identify yourself and state your affiliation, and let's get going.
Certainly. Thank you very much. I'm Bill Behrens, and I'm the Director of Division of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska. I appreciate the time that Tom spent. That was a good overview of broad topics of facility sharing. And I know that I've got a bit of a limited time. So what I'm trying to do here with the series of slides that I've got is to try and put some actual production data up for the committee to see, so that then we can have a dialogue about how the concepts that of facility sharing are impacted by actual production and reservoir management.
And for purpose of the record, I want to thank the Division of Oil and Gas. I had submitted some questions to them, and they responded in June, and that is included in your packet of information. So anyway, thank you to you and the entire division for responding.
Sure. And what I've done, Mr. Chairman, is included in the packet that we've delivered to you is something called Appendix. That is all of the slides that we presented to you in terms of production data. What I've got in this presentation is a bit of I've trimmed it down for expediency and dialogue. The first slide that we've got is the Prudhoe Bay unit, and it's really, we're looking at the green is oil plus NGLs, and the blue is water production. And to one of your original questions, this is, with the exception of the scale in terms of volume, this is a very typical exhibit of what you would expect to see in a oil reservoir that is has water drive mechanism, which means you have naturally occurring water that from the edge or the base of the reservoir moving in support of the pressure of the reservoir, and a field that is under water flood. So this is a very typical curve that you would see. A fairly flat plateau after initial production, then it began to decline. And the inverse is also true with the water. Very low up front, and then increasing over time, and then also beginning to flatten out. The next graph that I'm showing is something that is typically not looked at, is the total fluid versus the total liquids. Now, this is total liquids includes all water and all oil combined. Part of what I want to try and show is that that over time, especially since roughly January of 01, well, 01 to date, total fluid production through the field at Prudhoe is essentially the same. I mean, there's some wild variations due to facility upsets or seasonality or et cetera. But part of the discussion we're having is, to the general public, they look at the pipeline and go, gosh, you're at 600,000 barrels. You were at 2 million barrels. Clearly, there's excess capacity. The answer is there's clearly excess capacity in the pipeline. If you look at this exhibit, this would tell you that, in fact, their facilities that they're processing the oil and gas from or through is fairly well at capacity. And this exhibit kind of shows it. In general, or in simplistic terms, at the outset of a design of a facility, and keeping this incredibly simple so that people can understand, process engineers will work with their reservoir engineering counterparts, to try and get an idea of how big the field is and what kind of flow capacities there will be. And they will design a facility around those initial concepts. For example, if you build a facility to handle 1,000 barrels a day, when you first bring it on, for just talking numbers, you might have 900 barrels of oil and 100 barrels of water. That's at the initial phase of the production. 20 years into the life, you now have 100 barrels of oil and 900 barrels of water. You are still at facility capacity because you're still processing 1,000 barrels of fluid.
And that's the natural dynamics of a mature field.
That is a natural dynamics of a field. And in some fields, it is more rapid. Some it's slower. Typically, what happens is oil fields begin at their outset as oil fields, and at the end of their life, they become world-class water processing plants. I've worked in fields in Wyoming that are literally started out at 1% water cut, and are now at 99% water cut, and they are still stripping oil out. So that's a very typical reaction. Taking a look at two combined curves, the first one is the water-oil ratio, which is a measure of how much water is brought in with the oil, and the second one is the gas-oil ratio. And some of this was introduced earlier in testimony. To the point that was asked, the oil-water ratio at inception in Prudhoe was incredibly low, essentially zero. And that's what you would expect. And it's now approaching almost four to one, which is what we would call an 80% water cut. That would tell me, as a former reservoir engineer, that there is still robust life left in the field in terms of oil production. Again, you're now just having to manage water at a much higher volume. In terms of the gas, what you're seeing here is the natural gas breakout. You're also seeing a result of gas cycling, and you're also seeing an impact due to reservoir pressure. As reservoir pressure drops, more gas breaks out of your oil, which increases your oil gas recovery, which then begins to compound the problem. Another problem that exists in these mature fields is water is heavier than oil, just physical gravity. It's denser. It weighs more. As you produce fluids out of a reservoir, if you do not put enough fluid back in, your natural pressure of your reservoir is going to decrease. The more that you lose reservoir pressure, the harder it is to extract the oil out of the reservoir because you still have to lift it out. At the initial phase of a field, you have what's typically called free flow. It will flow on its own without artificial lift. Artificial lift is, there's various means of artificial lift, which is alternate means that engineers put in place to aid in recovery of the oil out of the wellbore. It could be what we call gas lift, which is actually injecting gas down inside the tubing and lightening the fluid column of the well so it produces. It could be pumps. It could be rod pumps. It could be jet pumps. I mean, it could be the rocking horses that you see as you drive through Western America. Those are all kinds of artificial lift that as your reservoir pressure has declined so much, it can no longer lift the fluid out by itself. drilling down a little bit more, what I've got here is a diagram of the gas oil ratios at Prudhoe Bay by facility. So the flow stations and the gathering centers are listed, and what you're seeing is also something that would be very, very well expected in terms of where the facilities are located and where the oil that is being extracted is regionally from. For example, the green line down at the very bottom, the blue line at the very bottom is Lisburn, so let's just put that off to the side because it's its own separate distinct reservoir. If you look at GC2, which is the green one, the fetch basin for GC2 is much more in the water leg. It's more affected by the water flood, which means it's not necessarily in the gas cap. So the wells produced for GC2 are not near the gas cap. So you would see a lower GOR, which is what you're seeing. Now, if you were to look at the water oil ratio, GC2 would probably be higher because it's affected by more of the water flood. Conversely, if you look at flow station 1, you look at GC1, and you look at flow station 3, FS3, those are all very much getting gassed out. Those are all the wells that they are working from are predominantly within the gas cap, near the gas cap, or affected by much more gas cycling efforts. So this is something that you would very typically see. The conundrum becomes for shared facilities is where is the new facility, where is the third party coming into, what kind of product is he bringing, and it gets even more complicated sorts of to Senator Wagner's question, is this gets into an incredible dynamic issue of reservoir management. In fact, one of the operators, or both of the major operators up there, have incredibly sophisticated numerical simulations that they run on a very routine basis. And they look at where they think wells will begin to what we call gas out or water out. They then plan their workover programs, their drilling programs, and their shut-in programs to minimize the impact of the water or the gas fronts as they come into those areas. To work through that in a facility sharing program gets even more dynamic because they are trying to manage these reservoirs to the very best of their ability, which is incredibly complicated. Now thinking that they're going to have to back out wells prematurely actually then could have a significant knock-on effect on ultimate recovery, which is where AOGCC would line up going, wait a minute, we've got to talk this all the way through in terms of, do we really have an understanding of, if we do back these wells out, will we in fact ever get that oil back? That's the really the hard push pull between those two groups. Looking now at Kuparuk, you see something again. This is the Kuparuk reservoir. Again, the green is your oil, and your blue is your water production. Very similar response in terms of what you would expect in terms of plateau of your oil, then your decline. Again, the next slide is your total liquids versus your water injection. Again, a very similar picture can be seen between this and Prudhoe. Interesting point, though. The Kuparuk Reservoir is separate, distinct, and very much different in terms of its fluid characteristics. For example, the Kuparuk River unit, the gas oil ratio, is just now at about 2, whereas Prudhoe is at about 25. Part of that is how much gas cycling has been going on, and part of that is a directly associated with what kind of oil is in Kuparuk. It is less gassy. It's a completely different quality of crude. These are the dynamics that the companies have to deal with when they're trying to figure out exactly how to design their facilities and how to work in shared facilities. Again, a very similar exhibit for your oil ratio from your different facilities at Kuparuk. Again, this is what you would expect relative to where the wells are draining from going into those facilities. This is, and I do apologize as I was looking at this sitting in the gallery. I'll have to get this updated. There's an entire section that's blank at Prudhoe Bay Unit where I have handling limits and comments, and it's blank, and I apologize for that. It didn't get updated. In general, as Tom alluded, everything is full, one way or another, either because of gas handling issues, water handling issues. Badami is open. There's some capacity there. The Pioneer operations and the E&I operations, we're still trying to figure out what kind of capacity they might have as far as facility sharing. All of this is very dynamic.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just can you define what full means? So in a layman's term, does that mean they're running at basically full speed and they just can't, under the current structure up there, they can't produce more oil than they're already producing because they're constrained out?
Through the chair, Senator, if I might, flow from any individual well or flow through a facility are really two a little bit different definitions. The flow capacity of a well is going to be defined by the energy of the reservoir and or the introduction of an artificial lift system or pumps to extract it. And that becomes a limiting factor of that type of artificial lift operation. In a discussion of flow through the facility, again, I would come back to my 1,000-barrel-a-day facility example, is they are capacity limited either because of too much water, too much gas to put in any more oil, because it's a dynamic system. The wells have to flow to the flow stations or the GCs. Those wells contribute to that production that's going through the facility. If the facility can only handle 1,000 barrels a day, it's the mix. So then they have to figure out which wells they can produce relative to reservoir management to optimize and maximize the recovery of the reserves.
Director Behrens, is the short answer to Senator Stedman's question yes?
I believe the question was, can you define flow?
Well, if one looks at throughput into the pipeline now, that is a result of the cumulative constraint of all of these facilities on the Central North Slope, which are full.
Through the chair, yes. That, understanding the question in that manner, yes.
Thank you. Senator French.
And just to put an operator's perspective on it, you know, for the folks watching at home, it means that something's going to pop if you put more oil in there. Either your separators are going to have too much pressure in them and you're going to flare gas, or you're going to overheat a turbine and it's going to shut down because you're driving it too hard. I mean, you're at the physical limits of the plant, and you just can't put anything else through there.
Through the chair, that's a good example. There's been a lot of debottlenecking work, and debottlenecking is a term that we use in the industry that. For example, on the portion of the separator that is for water, originally it might be designed or installed at, say, 3-inch diameter. By the time you get 20 years later, that piece of pipe has been changed out numerous times and now may be 20 inches in diameter. The vessel hasn't changed size, but you're putting in a bigger piece of pipe to remove fluid.
Senator French, follow-up.
And I don't know if we're going to go till 6 o'clock because this is a great conversation and we need to at some point, but, I mean, debottlenecking is the key word. And it's a conversation that I think we're all going to have with the administration and with the industry and so forth and find out, you know, where is it on the North Slope right now that's really constraining new oil? And you know, where can either a tax change or an investment change make a difference to the pipeline? Because that's the key question.
Senator Wilikowski.
Paul, I'd step out for a minute, and maybe I missed this, but I guess from my perspective, if new oil is found on the North Slope in Prudhoe, Kuparuk, would the current facilities be able to handle that new oil discovery?
Through the chair, the production facilities probably not, but the pipeline could.
Just to be clear, to get to the pipeline, you got to go through the facility.
To the chair, no, sir, that's not necessarily correct.
I mean, if you had 100% oil,
then if you can...
Which didn't need treating, then theoretically, if it was 100% oil with no gas or no water, it could go directly into the pipeline, right?
It could go into any of the oil transit lines on the slope.
Okay. Can I just follow up on that, Mr. Chair? What? How often do you get 100% oil coming out of the ground?
Through the chair, let's back up just a little bit, and this also kind of addresses one of the questions that Senator Wagner asked. In terms of companies' perspectives on do they build their own facilities or do they try and have shared facilities? Some of that is a corporate philosophy. But to your question, Senator, you very rarely get 100% oil out of the ground at inception. But what you would do is you would design your own process facilities and then ship the oil off of your facility to the oil transit lines. So you would build your own standalone process facility for your own benefit. That's typically the way the industry actually does it.
So not to sort of mince words or anything, but if new oil was discovered at Prudhoe or Kuparuk, with the current processing facilities, is it fair to say that very little of that new oil would be able to make it to the pipeline because the processing facilities simply can't handle dealing with the gas and water that is likely to be in that total composition?
Through the chair, if the requirement was for that oil, that product, to go through the existing facilities, it would not make it in. But that is not a requirement for development.
Senator French.
I feel like we've gotten off in the weeds. Chances are, if they found new oil at Prudhoe or Kuparuk, it's going to be lower GOR oil than what's currently in those facilities. They'd make room for it. It would be to their economic benefit to make room for it.
Through the chair, that would be correct.
And that's one point. The second point is no one's going to drill a well on the North Slope and expect to get it in the pipeline without it going through a production facility.
To the chair, Senator French, it would not necessarily have to be any of the existing facilities.
It's going to go through a production.
It will go through a production. That is correct. That's what I was trying to explain is the companies would build their own transport.
One of your earlier answers sounded like, no, you can just go ahead and flow it straight to the pipeline.
No. It would be processed. Yes. It would be processed
in a new one
that stand alone.
Does the job.
Correct.
Senator Wilkins.
Not forget it. Yes.
Please continue. I think I'm enjoying the presentation, listening to this, because I think it's an important topic that people all around Alaska are going to need to listen to.
Absolutely, Senator. Actually, this is the last slide I've got in terms of production and production sharing. The next series of slides is relative to new technologies. Do you want to proceed with that?
I think it might be better to do that on another day, and we would certainly accommodate your schedule, Director Behrens. We've gone over, beyond, but...
At your pleasure, sir.
Director Behrens, again, thank you very much. Senator Wagner.
Just one question while I was listening to your discussion about capacity and facility sharing. Is there a point at which a company would make a decision to try to go into the existing facilities and share it because of the amount of oil they were producing? In other words, does the size of their discovery and what they're going to produce have a bearing on whether they want the larger facilities or would they would bring in their own facilities and build their own facility?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I'd have to think about that just a little bit, because again, some of this gets back to corporate culture. Every company has its own preconceived idea and how they will want to develop their property. On one hand, if it's very small, companies might say, it's a very small producing horizon. If I can get it in, if I can shoehorn it in and work through the commercial issues, then I would prefer to do that. If it's very big, the likelihood is they will do their own. There are many companies that just go, regardless of size, and some of the new technologies that actually I didn't want to mention, but I wasn't in the presentation, is some of the new ideas of truckable modules that are very small in terms of overall size that can be bundled together and brought onto location fairly quickly.
Senator French, one question. Senator Wilkowski, and then we can wrap things up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe you can just give us a couple of sentences on how heavy oil fits into this facility-strained north slope, and particularly with respect to Milne Point, which is where BP is doing their CHOPS program, and its impact there.
Certainly. The heavy oil, especially the CHOPS, and I can jump to the slides if you want me to. The interesting part about heavy oil is that it is, the test that they've just recently had on one well was actually very positive. It was roughly 650 barrels a day of heavy oil being extracted through a positive displacement pump or a progressive cavity pump. And I mean, just it's basically, if anybody's ever drilled a post hole with a hand auger, it's a really high state-of-the-art hand auger that just moves a common set of fluids up through a progressive cavity. It's Archimedes screw. But the idea that where this blends, to your question, Senator, is to move that product into the pipeline. It will have its own standalone facility, because bringing up with that oil is a tremendous amount of sand. So you have to break out the oil from the sands. The sand has to drop out of the system into its own vessels. That sand has to be removed. The oil then is still very viscous, has to be blended with the diluent, which is the current production of the North Slope. So a lighter crude is then blended with the heavy crude to get it to where that it can be moved into the pipeline itself, into the transit lines and on into TAPS. So there is a real need for overall project integration for the successful completion of the CHOPS program across Milne Point. You've got to have a blend of those two crudes to get into the overall system downstream.
Senator Wilikowski, you.
Yes, one question, two parts. Part one is, and I didn't get to ask this of the prior presenter, but there was a statement made that no oil currently being held up due to facility sharing issues. And I've heard just the opposite over the years. I've heard this is a big issue, particularly for the smaller independents coming in. They just don't have, it would be extremely expensive for them to build facilities of their own. So I'm curious if you've heard otherwise, or if you're aware of concerns about facility sharing from any companies out there. And then part two would be, do you think we need to make any statutory changes on the issue of facility sharing?
Through the chair, Senator, I would echo what the previous witness commented, that I do not know of any oil that has not been allowed in the line or is being held up. I don't know of any. I do know that there have been very healthy and robust discussions by many players in terms of the complexity of facility sharing. And what the division is trying to do is encourage people and companies not to necessarily to think about process facility sharing, but more in terms of overall facility sharing, roads, pads, power, people, camps, things that can minimize the cost and decrease the cost to a new player and maximize overall throughput from all of North Slope. To your second question, I don't see a need at this time to make anything statutorily requiring facility sharing, because it is an incredibly complex reservoir management, physical asset management, and commercial agreement. And those are incredibly complicated, and it's just too dynamic, and every one of them is different.
Thank you.
I would personally thank Mr. Tom Walsh from Petrotechnical Resources, and also, Mr. Bill Behrens, Director of Division of Oil and Gas. I found this both presentations today to be extremely informative and helpful, I believe, to this committee and all Alaskans listening. So, again, thank you to the both of you. With that, we are adjourned.